Natalia could not walk unaided. She walked, but she walked without purpose, wandered, and here in the high rocks down through which they climbed, to take a false step might be fatal. Rourke alternated, holding her hand or her elbow as they moved. Natalia, from time to time, passed a haunting smile across her lips, as if she were dreaming of something pleasant, yet totally awake. The grazing wound he sustained to his right arm made the arm feel stiff at times, but there was no real pain. Between his weapons and hers, he no longer trusted her with anything with which she might do herself harm, he carried considerable weight. The weight of the helmets was added to his twin Detonics miniguns and the two Scoremasters, and the 629, her L-frame Smith 357s, and her suppressor-fitted Walther PPKS, his knives, and hers. He kept the helmets because of their integral radio sets. The radios might be their only means of extraction. Rourke turned to look at Natalia. Her unblinking eyes gazed into an unknown distance. Her lips moved as if to speak his name, but no sound passed those beautiful lips.
I'm here. Please, come back to me. It's beautiful here. All right, I'm just going for a walk. Hold on to my hand.
She continued to mouth his name.
I'm here, Natalia.
Report coming in now from Hekla, Comrade Colonel Antonovich.
Read it back to me, Corporal.
Yes, Comrade Colonel. Headquarters Command Code Orange. Operation Storm, Sigma Sector. Advancing against Hekla Cone. Heavy fighting at enemy base outside Cone. Aggregate loss of personnel and equipment, 13% overestimate. Continuing advance. Need more air support.
All right. Try to get him his air support.
Antonovich passed through the communications control center as quickly as he could now before another message arrived. It was going as he expected, the casualty rates higher than anticipated, but as yet not unacceptable. He passed through the airlock of the hermetically sealed tent and into the cold late afternoon air. No coat, only his uniform blouse and the shirt beneath it. He ran his fingers back through his hair. The one he wanted to hear from, he had not heard from, Nikita Achinsky. Once Achinsky attained his objective, then all the madness would stop and victory would be at hand. He felt more than heard anything from behind him, turned abruptly toward the communications tent, and saw the usually somber face of his adjutant.
Comrade Colonel, Achinsky reports a major element of the enemy land forces destroyed. Their lines of reinforcement and supply broken. He is advancing on the second Chinese city, Comrade Colonel.
The missiles! Any word of these?
No mention, Comrade Colonel. I can recontact.
No, not yet. Let him go on.
If only, Antonovich almost verbalized, Prokopyev had not been lost. The muscles around the repaired shoulder dislocation hurt far more than the flesh around the gunshot wound to his other shoulder. Why did Michael Rourke save his life? Prokopyev asked himself for the 100th time. The name Rourke was used to frighten the small children of the underground city. It represented a terrorist and murderer. Was Michael the son of such a man? Was the beautiful, sensitive Annie the daughter of such a man? And the Jew, Rubinstein, husband of Rourke's daughter, why would such a man of obvious bravery and goodness be so devoted to a man such as John Rourke? The facts seemed evident. Rourke was an enemy, but a noble one. All Rourkes were enemies, but noble enemies. The rest of what he had been taught to believe was a convenient lie. Lies, of course, were the bulwark of statecraft. And official lies such as this were policy. Policy based on lies to achieve what end? Vasily Prokopyev was determined now not to believe the lie. This clear in his mind, he began the complex process of sorting out his options. John Rourke was a war criminal, but as a commando of the elite corps, the major's job was not to seek out war criminals. Yet as its commander, his directive was the welfare of the state, which dictated, of course, that John Rourke and all the Rourke family must die. Yet John Rourke was, in all likelihood, dead. As to the rest, circumstance had made them comrades. And all his life he had been taught that loyalty to one's comrade was second only to one's loyalty to the state. At the moment, the state was an abstraction. His comrades were real. He had read many suppressed books. In one, he found a curious reference to a man named Sartre and a concept labeled situation ethics. Prokopyev realized that he was, after all, the living proof that such books were dangerous to the unwitting reader. Snow fell heavy in the lower elevations, and as Rourke and Natalia pressed on throughout the waning daylight hours, they penetrated more deeply into the storm. With the cover of the snowfall, it would be less likely they could be spotted from the air by the Soviet air power. With no radiation detection equipment available to him, it would be safer to melt snow for water than avail himself of the local water supply, albeit that a bushel's worth of snow was needed to produce a pint of drinking water. With the lack of appropriate shelter materials and the coming of the colder temperatures of the night, the snow would serve as insulation and artificially elevate the temperature, and could possibly be used to insulate what shelter he could build. He left Natalia in a niche of rocks protected from the wind, wrapping her in the blanket, half tempted to leave his parka over her as well. But reason prevailed over emotion. Should he become ill, her chances of survival in her present state would be zero. The snow fell in large flakes, clinging to his eyelashes and his hair, the hood down, the skin of his cheeks tingled with the cold, but his body warmed from exercise. John Rourke's right fist clenched the haft of the Life Support System 10, handmade for him 5 centuries before by the Weatherford, Texas knife maker Jack Grain. He brought the primary edge down against the base of the 5-foot-tall pine tree's trunk repeatedly, toppling the fir easily. He heaved it into the pile with others he had already cut. The abundant pine trees would give him what he needed to build a shelter. He didn't resheath the LX-10 knife because of the pine tar on the blade that would have to be removed. As he began hauling the trees toward the site he picked for their shelter, he realized the snow was falling more rapidly, more heavily. Michael Rourke brushed the snow from his eyes and squinted down into a depression where perhaps centuries ago a river ran, below the rocks in which he and Annie now lay side by side. Men and equipment from the Chinese second city moved along its course. Annie held the microphone of her helmet radio to her mouth.
Paul, we have a concentration of troops from the second city closing in on our direction. We may have to evacuate this position. Any word on Daddy? Over.
There's no sign of him ever having been in this vicinity. We're crossing the river at the earliest opportunity. Snow in there too? Over?
Yes. Very heavily. Don't cross the river.
We have to. If they're in trouble, with this snowfall, it'll only make things worse for them. We'll be out of radio contact in another few miles. We need a rendezvous. Over.
I know you have to do what you think is best, but
how... We need a rendezvous. Have Michael check your map. I'm thinking of G7 on the revised grid your dad made over the German maps. The prominent feature. I don't want to get more specific in case we're being monitored.
Already, Michael was folding the topographic map into the proper segment. There was a structure atop a plateau of modest elevation. The river ran past it in a lazy snake shape.
Tell him I see the spot. Set a time, Annie.
Paul, Michael has the location pinpointed.
She was looking over Michael's shoulder now.
When? Over.
24 to 36 hours from now is the latest we'll be. Over.
That's too long. If the Russians knock out the second city, there should be scattering Chinese troops all over the area, not to mention the Russians themselves. Over.
24 hours, then. I need that. Over.
Affirmative on that. I love you. Tell Otto to be careful, too. And find Daddy and Natalia.
I will, sweetheart. Out.
Michael Rourke looked into his sister's eyes. They were tear-rimmed.
I'm really afraid.
I know that. So am I. But if anybody can do it, Paul can. And as soon as we reach the rendezvous, you and Maria can keep an eye on Prokopyev, and Han and I can join the search.
Michael turned back to look into the gulch below them and the Chinese forces. Withdrawing or moving into some new strategic posture?
Damn.
John Rourke walked through the snow into their clearing in the woods. He carried several large pieces of bark he skinned from a large tree deeper in the woods. As he walked, he checked the fresh snow for signs of rabbit or anything larger, remembering once again the tales told by Han Lu Chen of the Chinese wolves. He spotted tracks of wood rats and mice occasionally, but nothing he looked forward to eating. It was hard to imagine that the Chinese of the Second City saved such humble creatures throughout the centuries for release into the wild by design. He presupposed poor management instead. There was no sign of larger animal life. Confident that he had enough bark to satisfy his needs, Rourke pushed one end of a good-sized tree trunk into the fire. The fire burned just outside one end of the shelter he built of pine boughs and bared branches. The tree trunk began to catch with the aid of fat lighter he gathered from nearby pines and with which he started the fire originally. It was crystallized pine tar, one of nature's great combustibles. Rather than using a match, since they might be precious later, and his Zippo, so soaked it would not light, he made a bow-shaped fire starter, aided with magnesium shavings from the stick of magnesium he carried in his musette bag. Natalia lay resting. It was warm enough beneath the pine bough shelter. He removed his coat, rolled up his shirt sleeves, and set to work with the bark. He could use the old woodsman's method, but he never liked it. To boil water by hollowing out a segment of log, then fire-heating stones and applying them with improvised tongs to a container of water until the temperature was elevated to the boiling point, always struck him as doubling the work. At any event, it was necessary to avoid stones which would either burst or turn to slivers when quenched in the cold water. His great problem was the water itself, since he was using snow. He began roasting some of his materials over the stone-encircled fire, whittling with the grain knife on small pegs of pine. The former method presupposed a kettle of some sort in which to heat the water. Instead, he opted for the more esoteric, yet to his reckoning practical method, making a kettle and simply heating it with the existing fire. For this, he needed the thinner inner bark of the tree, which he worked to separate from the coarser, uneven outer bark, using the grain LX-10. After some careful cutting, he had a roughly square sheet, nearly 12 inches on a side, which he roasted to the point now where it became suitably malleable. Folding the opposing corners together to form a triangle at the newly formed apex, he folded once again. Eyeing the creases carefully, Rourke turned the bark section over, then began the next sequence of folds. Now folding along the scribed lines made by the folds, he formed overlapping corners, securing them with one of the suitably sized slivers of pine he previously sharpened to have points at one end. He did the same with the other set of corners, forming a box-shaped object under 6 inches square and less than 4 inches deep. He had constructed the fire with an eye toward the kettle, and the most important factor to remember in its use was that the flame could only contact that portion of the kettle where there was actually liquid. If it touched the sides, the kettle would burn. He set the kettle into the snow beside the fire, then proceeded to pack snowballs, impaling these on forked branches. He let the snowballs melt into the kettle near the fire. It was a tedious process, but necessary. Once there was a sufficient amount of water that he could leave a residue in the pot, it would be simpler. While the snowballs melted, he began working other sheets of bark into needed utensils, namely a drinking cup and a water bucket. He taught Michael and Annie years ago how to make such items, even though Annie was quite young. After he woke them from the sleep, and before he returned to it, he retaught such skills. Annie seemed particularly fascinated with the crafting of a folding bark cup. Little better than half the size needed for a kettle, the method was basically similar, the volume of the cup approximately 1/4 pint, or as he explained it to them when they were little, half as much as a school milk carton. The cup was easily folded and could be closed against dirt from the pocket. A sufficient quantity of snow melted, Rourke began heating it on flat stones over the fire with a small gap through which the flame could reach only the base of the kettle, reducing the likelihood of burning to zero. As the water warmed, he added more snow, melting more snowballs into the bucket for future use. He worked with the remaining bark, grinding it with stones into something the consistency of rough flour. He gradually added melted snow until it became sufficiently dough-like that he could form it into crudely shaped tortilla-like sheets. He placed them aside for later cooking. A glance by the firelight at the black face of his Rolex told him it was about time to check the few crude traps he'd laid earlier when he went into the woods for the larger tree. Adding more of the snowball drippings to his kettle, edging the log farther into the fire, he was confident the fire was still low enough that he didn't have to worry about total evaporation, even if the water should begin to boil. Rourke checked Natalia. Her condition remained the same. She lay seized by a deep and restless sleep from which he prayed she would awaken restored, but feared she would not. Rourke rolled down his sleeves, donned his coat, and picked up his knife, then passed the primary edge through the flame several times, quickly, to burn off the pine tar, which was highly flammable. The steel didn't stay in the fire long enough to affect temper. He used a snowball to wipe the knife clean, then dried it on his trouser leg and put it in its sheath. He gathered up several of the longer shavings from his all-purpose tree for use if short-term emergency lighting should prove necessary. Quickly, Rourke left the shelter, moving through the deep snow to his self-styled trap line. If the snow persisted, by morning he would need to fabricate snowshoes, the most suitable style being the tailless bear paw design, considering the mountainous terrain. Their blunt toe shape proved useful in kicking to form a step in the snow. They were the simplest to use. He slugged onward, moving deeper into the trees in the gathering darkness, mindful of the fact that his flashlight still worked, but unwilling to waste battery power until and unless it was needed. Perhaps 300 yards from the shelter, John Rourke stopped, frozen in his tracks, by a sound he had not heard in 5 centuries. So much for Chinese wolves, he thought. Those were feral dogs. The sound of the dogs moved between him and the hut. Though the fire was sheltered from aerial observation, by design, it would be visible at ground level. The fire would keep the creatures away from the hut, perhaps driving them toward him. His mind raced. Hunting? Perhaps. Or fleeing the war between Russians and Second City Chinese? Perhaps both. No tracks showed such creatures in the nearby area earlier. Rourke considered his options. A gunshot in these woods would be heard for miles, might be just enough to draw the attention of stray enemy forces, and with 2 enemies, double the chances. John Rourke unsheathed the Life Support System 10. He looked quickly to right and left. He crouched and brought the 12-inch buoy-patterned blade down quickly against a sapling, perhaps 3 feet in height. With the LX-10, he quickly chopped off the boughs, then stabbed the grain knife into a nearby trunk. He reached under his coat to the small of his back, where he carried the little A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome sheathed. He drew out the knife, fitted it to the base of the boughless pine, then drew the long, thin shavings from his pocket. His musette bag, with his spare bootlaces, lay back at the shelter. Quickly, but as stoutly as time allowed, Rourke bound the Sting 1A to the shaft of the sapling. The howling and yelping was blood-curdlingly close now. The improvised flexible spear in his right hand, he snatched the LX-10 from the tree trunk, then withdrew into deeper tree cover. What would slow his movement would slow theirs. What might all but discourage him might very well discourage them, unless they were very hungry indeed. Then he saw twin balls of fire looking toward him, glowing, moving through the gray fog of dusk and swirling snow. Feral dogs indeed, but as lupine in appearance as any true wolf he had seen. Then another pair of eyes, as the first pair's body took shape. Then a third pair of eyes, the first pair's attendant form now fully defined. Rourke edged back. If it would be life or death, he would use a gun, but it would have to be that. 3 more materialized through the snow, making 6 in all. They were coming for him. He wondered if they smelled the same fear he felt. The pack advanced. John Rourke moved as the pack leader, larger as anticipated, sniffed at the snowy ground, as if scenting something which wasn't properly there. Then the creature wheeled directly toward him, fewer than 12 yards away. Rourke's right hand tightened on the shaft of the makeshift spear. The creature lunged. Rourke's weapon penetrated the creature beneath the sternum. Rourke ducked left and down, rolling. The beast's body tumbled away into the snow, inches from where Rourke had stood. The animal rolled in a death agony. The second wolf lunged for him. Rourke grabbed the 629. As the animal's arc of motion brought him within reach, Rourke's right arm arced outward, backhanding the revolver's 6-inch barrel across the animal's face. Rourke wheeled right, made a saber thrust with a grain knife, in and withdrew as the animal fell. John Rourke turned to face the rest of the pack. She twirled once in front of the mirror, the silk skirts of the almost midnight blue dress she wore gently fanning out from her ankles. The glass slippers on her feet caught the firelight, sparkling to rival the diamonds at her throat, her ears, her wrists, all but the diamond on the 3rd finger of her left hand, which was at once enormous, yet tasteful, beautiful. She heard his footsteps along the tiled wooden floor behind her and felt her heart skip, saw his image in the mirror and felt her cheeks flush. Natalia turned toward him so abruptly that the fabric of her dress rustled.
Hello.
In a single word, John Rourke said more to her than any man had ever begun to express in 10,000. He reached out to her, beneath the French cuff of his white shirt, the simple elegance of his stainless steel Rolex wristwatch caught the firelight as well. His fingers stroked gently at the bareness of her neck. She bent her face to his wrist, her lips softly caressing the strength in his hands. He took a step back from her, shrugging his massive shoulders so slightly that she would not have noticed had not her eyes been in thrall to his every movement. Her hands touched the black butterfly bow centered at the front of the white collar of his shirt. The black pearl studs of his shirt front rose and fell gently as he breathed. He took her into his arms, the texture of his tuxedo wonderfully rough against her bare chest and arms and shoulders, her breasts pressing against the fabric of her bodice, tight against him.
I love you.
But she knew that. John Rourke bent his face over hers and his lips parted. She closed her eyes. The floor beneath them seemed to rise up. The fire that had cast its warm glow over the ballroom where she had waited for him for how long now consumed the ballroom. She was surrounded by it. She bunched her dress tight around her as she dropped to her knees, huddling there as the fires rose in yellow walls around her. Her ring, it was not a diamond, yet it was, but it was no longer blue or white, but blood red like a ruby. The heat invaded her lungs, her arms folding over her breasts. The heat seared her flesh. Why didn't he save her? John Rourke touched his left hand to her neck, raising her head just a little.
This is really good tasting. I amazed myself. It's kind of a stew. Neither of us has really eaten in quite a while. We both need some nourishment.
He parboiled the wolf flesh just to be on the safe side.
This'll taste good. A little hot, but that'll warm you up inside, and you'll be feeling better in no time. And at any minute now, I expect Annie and Paul to come rolling up. Annie'll get you feeling your old self, Natalia. When she was a little girl and I was very tired or depressed, I'd help tuck her in at night and get her to give me a kiss and then a hug, and then I'd have her pat me on the shoulder or back. She started at one time when she knew things weren't going right somehow, and it made me feel better. So we started kidding about it, and I'd say, "Now give me a pat so I feel good." And she'd give me a pat. Well, the funny thing was that it always made me feel better. So when Annie does get here, you tell her you want her to give you a big hug and then a pat. And don't forget the part about the pat, because that's important. But right now, you gotta eat, so you'll feel strong again.
Slowly, with greater difficulty than he ever had feeding the children when they were little, he fed her. He used the bark spoon he made, catching at the bits of food as they dribbled from her mouth. She dirtied herself while he was gone, so he bathed her as necessary and covered her. After she was fed, he would have to wash out her things, dry them by the fire. Was she failing? Throughout the day, with his reminding her, she cared for her own bodily functions. He tried to tell himself that it was just that she had been sleeping too soundly, and in her exhausted and confused state, she had temporarily lost control. He didn't feel convinced.
Natalia.
Russian helicopters were ringing the second Chinese city. Fuel to burn, Michael Rourke surmised, just like the second city. Fires dotted the mountainside into which it had been built, heavy fighting at all the defensive positions. Their movement throughout the late afternoon and into the early evening, until the snow became too heavy to travel without lights, took them along the base of a high ridge, and because there was no choice, closer to the beleaguered second city. With Annie and Maria Lloyden flanking him despite his protests, Michael Rourke climbed the ridge to essay the condition of the battle. Maria moved close beside him.
In ancient times, it was not unknown for persons whose options had been entirely exhausted to risk destruction of self in order to defeat an enemy.
You mean their nuclear weapons, don't you?
Yes.
Michael Rourke looked from Maria to his sister.
You think they detonate a nuclear weapon?
Maybe they detonate them all. I mean, it would only take one if it were set off properly, wouldn't it?
I don't know, Annie. Yeah, maybe. Probably. Shit!
He started back down from the rocky ridge, his German binoculars still in his hands, and his hands were shaking, but not with the cold.
They would do it.
The Russian officer, Prokopyev, warmed his hands over the heater cooker. Annie stirred warm water into a packet of food, the five of them huddled inside the German field shelter. It was dome-shaped, radar-reflective, hermetically sealed against the elements, and fitted with a portable climate control system, which ran on pellets of solidified synth fuel. The combination didn't make them bake with the heat, but kept the chill low enough that with sweaters on, they could move about comfortably in the confined area with their parkas off. The wind chill factor outside the tent was approximately 34 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, if the emergency kits from the German supers were to be believed. And if anything, Michael Rourke thought they might be registering on the conservative side.
I cannot believe they would do this. I have spoken with the comrade colonel. He wants the nuclear weapons only so that he may threaten to use them and thus end the warfare, not to end the Earth.
Maybe. It's hard to imagine he wouldn't use them if he had to.
But...
She handed the food packet to Prokopyev and looked at him as he took it from her.
Grow up, Vasily, for God's sake. Maybe he isn't your damned hero marshal, but he's no saint either. Antonovich didn't survive as one of Karamazov's chief staff officers by being a goody-goody, for Christ's sake!
She's right, Vasily.
Maria gave Michael a food packet she'd made for him. He was quite capable of adding hot water to dried food and had been doing it for 5 centuries. But Maria and Annie, or perhaps Maria because of Annie, liked the busy work of the domestic chores of camp. Michael thought for a moment about Madison, his wife of so little time. She had been at her happiest when caring for them. He closed his eyes. He could still see her blonde hair and how it caught the light.
These are desperate, warmongering people. Their religion built on violence. Their culture stifled, primitive. And perhaps their understanding of the true nature of the weapons they possess so limited, they cannot imagine the destruction of which these weapons are capable. Perhaps they have already begun some irreversible process.
Madness.
Yes, like the mad person who pushed the first button and began the wars that nearly destroyed all life on this planet 5 centuries ago.
Prokopyev put his utensil in the food packet and looked at all of them in turn.
The suggestion is that we somehow seek to foil any plans for detonation the Chinese may have?
Chinese of the Second City! My people long ago mastered nuclear power in all respects and would never consider such a barbarous act.
There's Paul to consider. Once he's found Dad and Natalia, they may need medical help, God knows. And inside that city is no place for a woman. Prokopyev and I have been there. So has Han. If the two of you...
Michael looked at Annie and Maria.
If you guys could...
You mean if we helpless women were suddenly to become capable?
Listen, Annie, huh? If you and Maria go to the rendezvous with Paul and Otto, then get out of here. Maybe we could...
Michael really didn't know what maybe might be. But he was certain he would not allow his sister or the woman he loved to enter the Second City. He wasn't enthusiastic about going himself. His head still ached from the last time.
There is confusion everywhere. If you would allow me to contact my own forces, I could run the raid myself, and none of you need risk your lives. It would...
Vasily, if your people had the nuclear weapons they possess in the Second City, I wouldn't exactly rest easy. And it's not a matter of possession. It's a matter of guessing just how desperate they are in there, or how stupid, and just what they'll do with their backs to the wall. What was your intelligence assessment of their technological capabilities? You think they have the technical expertise to make something go off?
We had no way of knowing.
Prokopyev lowered his head, his face red-tinged by the glow of the heater, his eyes closed.
And you attacked the Second City?
Prokopyev raised his head and looked at Annie.
All military operations, Mrs. Rubinstein, incorporate a certain amount of calculated risk.
Incalculable risk? That's nuts!
Maria knelt beside Michael.
Various computer models were made concerning the technological abilities of potential survivors of what the Americans refer to as the Great Conflagration.
The Dragon Wing.
Yes. One of the models I found particularly intriguing, and because it seems to fit here, I am frightened. The computer model dealt with the concept of the medium of destruction evolving into an object of worship for those it had spared. The logic is primitive, but valid. And if such a society were to exist, which seems to be the case of the Second City, the model was extended to incorporate the possibility that some of the mechanics of operating such weapons of destruction might become incorporated into the religion's holy ritual. In theory, such ritual could be graduated. There are many examples. If the worshippers of the Second City see themselves facing some ultimate crisis, then the most ardent among them would seek consolation in their religion, perhaps some special ceremony. Such a special ceremony could include the ritual necessary to arm or detonate a warhead, sort of calling on the ultimate power of their god to spare them again, while at the same time vanquishing their enemies.
Her hand suddenly clasped Michael's left bicep very tightly. Michael Rourke just stared at the palms of his hands, listening to the soft hiss of the heater cooker, the muted howl of the wind outside, to the slapping sounds as a gust of wind struck at the shelter broadside.
We go inside if we can get there. There isn't any choice.
In the depths of himself, he knew he'd be a fool if he didn't take Maria Lloyden with him. What was in her mind might be their only chance for success. Paul Rubinstein and Otto Hammerschmidt prepared to cross the river.
Idle speculation, I know, my friend. But if only I had the facility to call up our combat engineers, we would have a bridge across which a tank could be taken, and it would be erected in under 10 minutes.
Well, the Russians had machines like that 5 centuries ago.
I studied them. German is better.
Hammerschmidt smiled wolfishly. Paul Rubinstein just shook his head. There was no bridge-laying equipment, just the rappelling gear from the emergency equipment aboard the specials. Paul smiled at the thought of the person at whose insistence each item of emergency equipment had been included. John Rourke, his friend, his father-in-law, in the most real sense of the word, his mentor, had once again planned ahead. With the ropes, there was a grappling hook that fired from a disposable launcher. The ropes were flat, made of something that reminded Rubenstein of the Kevlar material John once showed him in a bullet-resistant vest. The launchers were designed to fire upward, so he assumed they would fire outward as well. Paul realized it was a matter of trajectory, holding high enough that the spring-loaded grappling hooks would deploy over the object to which they hoped for attachment, rather than level with or below it. They had traveled down along the river's course for more than an hour, scouting a potential crossing, at last settling on a gap perhaps 25 yards across. But it was the depth that bothered him. The gorge through which the river cut so violently was at least 75 feet below them, and whitewater rapids made the water glow eerily despite the otherwise poor visibility of the snowstorm. Since it was impossible to get the specials across, they argued over it, then eventually flipped a German coin for it. Paul Rubenstein won. He would cross, explore the opposite bank on foot, Hammerschmidt waiting with the specials.
Are you ready, Paul?
Rubenstein brushed snowflakes from his eyelashes and nodded.
I'm ready.
He lied. He was at once impatient to be gone, but reluctant to crawl across a rope spanning a gorge attached on the opposite side by a randomly positioned grappling hook. Hammerschmidt put the launcher to his right shoulder.
A pity it doesn't have sights.
A real pity, yeah.
Paul wiped more snow from his eyes.
Then here it is.
His eyes tracked the roughly conical shape as it shot over the gorge. The flat rope uncoiled in its wake like a snake run over by a truck on some country road 5 centuries ago. Paul wondered if somewhere on Earth snakes survived. But before he decided anything concerning that, the grappling hook disappeared into a swirl of snow. Paul and Otto fell to tugging at the rope. The rope went taut. They both threw their weight on the rope, trying to pull it free lest it work itself free. The rope was as taut as a flat piece of metal. Together, they tied it off into the rocks near them, then further secured it to a tree and discarded the spent launcher.
I'll bury the launcher in the snow once you are across.
Hopefully that's all you'll bury. Give me a hand.
Together, they manipulated one of the specials into position beneath the stretched, taut rope. Paul Rubenstein tightened the sling of his Schmeisser submachine gun, tightened the strap of the Musette bag in which he carried his spare magazines. He checked the safety strap of the tanker-style holster in which his battered Browning high power was carried. These two firearms and his Gerber MK2 knife were all he would take. The bulk of his Arctic gear and the need to move fast and potentially far on foot defined his practical limits.
Are you certain you will not change your mind, Paul? I could rope over a rifle and a small pack
no.
and...
No, gotta travel light. And give me a leg up.
He mounted the saddle of the special, then grabbed the rope with his gloved hands. Hammerschmidt, taking his feet, helped him as he swung them up and over the rope. The rope was already crusting with ice.
Any famous last words?
Yeah, but I'm too polite to say them.
Paul started out, feet first, hand over hand. Hammerschmidt helped him the last 3 yards or so until he reached the edge. Then Paul was out over the gorge, the wind shrieking like a tortured soul, lashing at his body, at the rope, the flat rope vibrating with it.
I think I can.
He moved steadily, not daring to stop.
Oh, jeez. Don't look down, stupid.
Below, white water crashed over the rocks and flickered up toward him with beckoning fingers. He shook his head, kept moving, gauging that he was near the center of the gorge, the point of no return, where it no longer made sense to turn back. He would not, in any event. He kept moving, wishing suddenly he still smoked, thinking about Annie. He loved her and she loved him. If none of the other things that happened to him since meeting John Rourke on the very night of the war could be considered miraculous, then Annie and Paul's love could. She was pretty, brilliant, headstrong, gentle, loving. Everything he had ever wanted in life was part of her. Paul kept moving. Someday they'd have a child, more than one. He found himself smiling. John would be a grandfather. Paul looked down again, his fingers stiffening, his legs and forearms cramping, his shoulders aching.
Keep looking ahead, man.
He thought. He actually remembered nothing of it beyond what he was told after he recovered. about John Rourke edging across just such a precarious rope to rescue him from a flaming helicopter in the aftermath of Karamazov's attack on the Eden Project shuttles. The pain was something John felt. John had kept going. Now Paul kept going. His fingers barely able to close. The cold numbing him, too, now. The wind gusting, tearing at him. His hood blew down, and his ears and face suddenly tingled with the cold. But he kept moving.
Whoa!
Then the rope vibrated more strongly than it had before, and he didn't move. Upside down, he looked back, barely able to see Hammerschmidt by the very edge. Hammerschmidt gesticulated wildly, evidently shouting, but his words were lost in the wind. But the understanding was there. Hammerschmidt evidently thought the grappling hook was working loose. Paul Rubinstein looked ahead. The rope vibrated. He could cut the rope, swing toward the opposite wall of the gorge, hope to cling to something. The rope lurched, and Paul Rubinstein felt a sudden sick feeling in the pit of his stomach, an instant of total weightlessness, then a shock to his arms and legs and back. The rope swayed maddeningly. He realized the grappling hook's position had shifted. Cut the rope and swing toward the wall? What if he struck against the rock so hard that he died? Annie, a widow in a world like this? And John? And Natalia?
No!
Paul started moving again, but the ice on the rope, now that it swayed, was making him lose traction, and for each inch he moved forward, he slipped an inch downward, his relative position unchanged. He pulled. He'd never been the world's greatest athlete, having discovered muscles in his adulthood he'd never known he had as a child, but he swung his right elbow over the rope. Paul's arm tingled with pain as the rope gouged his muscles. He moved on and thought of Annie. Was she warm? John and Natalia. They had to be alive. He could see Hammerschmidt faintly, waving to him. Why? Encouraging him onward? Cheering his survival? He narrowed the gap to the far side of the gorge to under 10 yards.
Shit!
Otto was shooting at him. Had the German commando gone mad?
Otto! Holy crap!
Paul Rubinstein looked up and saw what Hammerschmidt was shooting at. He saw why the rope had slipped, why it vibrated again even now. The Chinese of the Second City had the most peculiar ideas of animal husbandry, he thought absently. Not only had they released wolves into the environment, but they released at least one bear. John Rourke's eyes opened.
Shots.
He had fallen asleep. Shots, but not a helicopter's miniguns. Automatic rifle shots, some distance away, but not too terribly far. Outside, as his senses came fully alert, he realized that the wind howled even more loudly than before. He pushed the log into the fire and threw up a shower of sparks, but the dampening effect of the snow on their shelter was enough that there was no concern for fire. It wasn't so warm within the shelter that he would have felt comfortable removing his shirt, but it wasn't so cold that he felt uncomfortable without his sweater. Rourke sat up, his right hand automatically closed on the butt of one of the little Detonics 45s, his left hand resting on Natalia's blanketed right leg. After feeding her, he climbed over the rock ledge into the deep drifts there by the height of the gorge and washed her clothing, then brought the things back and hung them over the fire to dry. Natalia still slept. He realized she was sleeping too much. Rourke was only keeping her body alive, while her mind kept slipping farther away. He was standing. He reached for the shoulder harness for the twin stainless Detonics and shrugged into it, holstering one gun, then the second. He grabbed the Scoremasters, thrust them into his belt. He looked at Natalia and grabbed his gun belt. Paul Rubinstein hung onto the shuddering rope with his left hand and both knees and feet, biting off the other glove from his right hand, his helmet slung from his musette bag, slamming into his abdomen as he twisted around, his right hand moving under his coat, grasping for the butt of the Browning. The bear was not so large as those he'd seen in zoos or stuffed in museums. Not a Kodiak or a polar bear, just a black bear of huge proportions and bulk, a white airfoil-shaped mask of fur beneath his eyes and over his mouth, giving the effect of some hideously inane smile. Paul thumbed back the hammer. The submachine gun would have been better, but there was no way to release the sling one-handed without risking dropping it into the river below.
Hey! Get out of here! Get out of here! Go on! Get! Move it!
The animal grabbed at the rope with one huge paw, then another. It stood nearly upright, stared at him, then bent over the rope, pulling at it. The rope slipped again. Rubinstein nearly lost his pistol. The grappling hook was visible now, barely wedged in the rocks near the animal's feet. Paul tried to aim. The bear stepped back, then reached down to swat at the rope once again. The grappling hook moved. John Rourke ran. The pistol shots he'd just heard convinced him it was something other than Russians or fleeing Second City Chinese. The 629 in his right fist, he clambered up into the natural rock wall separating the wooded area in which he had made camp from the river. The shots came from a considerable distance upriver along the course of the gorge. He could place the origin of the rifle shots and the pistol shots some distance apart. A gun battle between two men? He kept running along the river's edge as the snowfall became heavier. Movement grew more difficult. Snowshoes would be mandatory by morning. He kept running. Those pistol shots, there was something oddly familiar about them. The rifle fire, the sound not right for an M16, more like the German weapons.
Hammerschmidt!
Rourke quickened his pace, pulling his parka hood up against the numbing cold as he ran. The Browning high-power slide locked open, the pistol empty. The enraged bear swung at the grappling hook, as if the hook were the source of its bullet-inflicted pain. Paul Rubinstein's cold, numbed right thumb worked the battered Browning slide release downward, the slide skating forward. There was no chance to reload and no time either. As quickly as he could, he shoved the 9mm back into the tanker holster, closing the safety strap against loss. He took his outer glove from his teeth, worked his hand into it, then pulled along the rope again. The bear hammered so mightily at the grappling hook that the flat Kevlar-like rope swayed like some sort of hammock in a breeze. 7 yards now. 5. The bear seemed to be losing interest in the grappling hook, taking interest in him. Paul Rubinstein thought of the Gerber knife, a stout blade but slim defense against a creature this size. Still, it was his only defense. There would be no time for the subgun and no time to reload the high power. No time to run, either. The grappling hook slipped again, and he almost lost his handholds. The rope bellied down and out. His body slammed against the rocks and skidded. He wedged his right foot in the rock face and stopped himself, embracing the firmness of the rocks with his body. He looked up. There was a natural path, and the bear was starting down along it. Rubinstein tried remembering everything he could about bears. Generally, poor eyesight. Not all bears hibernated, although in extreme temperatures like these... But what was an extreme temperature for a bear? Paul had never been a hunter. He shot men before he ever shot game. He tried to gauge the creature's weight, at least 500 pounds. If a 500-pound angry man were coming at him, immune to pain, interested only in ripping him to shreds, what would he do? He laughed, despite it all. The likely answer to his self-questioning was obvious. He would most likely die. With the foothold, he was able to reach for the high power, buttoning out the magazine into his left hand, as the hand still held the rope. But he couldn't twist himself around to get at the musette bag.
Come on, I gotta have... Come on!
He searched his outside pockets, found a spare 13-round magazine, bracing the magazine between his heaving chest and the magazine well. He pushed it up and home. The slide was closed.
Ah, damn! What was it John taught me?
Sight snubbing is what they used to call it, Paul. It's something to practice occasionally in the event you need to work the slide of your pistol and only have one hand to do it. Not too good for the rear sight, but anything in a pinch if you have to.
Ow! Paul stabbed the rear sight of the Browning into his thigh and rammed the pistol downward. The slide came back, released, and snapped forward. The bear was 3 yards above him, on the rocky path that would bring the creature into range with its long front limbs, into range to rip Paul's body to shreds with its enormous claws. He realized his hand was shaking as he took aim with the high power.
It's good to see you, Paul!
From above him, Paul Rubinstein heard a familiar voice. He looked toward the sound. For an instant, saw John Rourke bending over the edge of the precipice. Then, in John's hands, he saw the .44 Magnum revolver. The creature's forehead burst, exploding in a cloud of pink and red and gray. The bear just swayed there for what seemed like forever, clawing toward the snow-obscured sky, then tumbled forward. Suddenly, Paul Rubinstein felt shame and rage that this creature, whose species survived so much, died because of him. He looked up into the face of John Rourke.
I know what you're thinking. I didn't want to kill it, but there wasn't any choice. I need your help.
John Rourke clambered down the path as he holstered his revolver.
Does your helmet radio work? Can you reach the base radio?
We didn't want to use it. The Russians could pick it up. And I'm out of range now, but we got a rendezvous. How's Natalia?
He was almost afraid to speak her name. Where was she?
Very sick.
His friend, John Rourke, reached out from the path, and Paul, his pistol holstered, reached back, their hands clasped.
Thank God you came.
Chances were good the gunfire would draw enemy personnel, either Russian or from the scattered forces of the Second City. Rubinstein walked beside John Rourke, although his muscles screamed at him to rest.
I know you need some rest, Paul, but we have to hurry. There isn't much time.
Using his helmet radio, Paul relayed to Otto Hammerschmidt on the other side of the gorge that John was well, but that Natalia was somehow injured, and they were going to aid her. Otto should stand by and watch for possible interdiction by enemy forces. It was bitter cold, but with the hood of his parka back on, at least Paul's ears and cheeks were beginning to thaw. He noticed that the left sleeve of John's parka was torn and carefully re-sewn, and noticed as well bloodstains on John's right sleeve.
What happened?
Everything that could possibly go wrong did. Almost. We were pursued by Second City Chinese forces, and there were Soviet gunships on us as well. I did the only thing I could.
John Rourke stopped dead in his tracks and looked at Paul earnestly.
What happened?
Natalia was already behaving strangely.
John resumed walking.
We went over the side into the gorge. We lost a special, got soaked to the skin. All she was doing was mouthing my name over and over again.
Mom said something about that.
She's completely withdrawn into herself. I'm no psychiatrist, but I think she's suffering deep emotional trauma.
She snapped?
John Rourke wheeled toward him, and for a split second, Paul Rubinstein thought that his friend might strike him. The look in John Rourke's eyes was something he'd never seen before.
Yeah, I think so. Come on!
They clambered over a rock ledge and down, the snow less deep as they neared the tree line, then veered left. Ahead in the distance, a fire glowed.
I had to risk a fire. She was freezing again. What?
Did she say anything else at all?
No. In the last few hours, she may have become incontinent. It was almost impossible to feed her.
Then you salvaged some food.
John Rourke smiled.
The wolves that were said to have been loosed by the Second City people, they're feral dogs.
John Rourke patted at the torn sleeve of his parka.
They provided adequate nourishment with the pine bark paste.
Yuck!
Yeah, that too.
They were nearing the fire. A lean-to of sorts constructed out of snow-laden pine boughs partially covered the fire as well. As they stopped before it, John Rourke grabbed his arm.
Whatever! I'm responsible for this, and we have to get her to help. Perhaps the Germans or at Midwake, I don't know.
He released Paul's arm and they entered the shelter. The warmth felt almost stifling to Paul with the sudden absence of the wind. Something smelled very good, and his eyes traveled to the fire. It was built in two segments, one more controlled for cooking, the other for warmth. On a line made from some sort of vine hung Natalia's clothing. Paul looked at John Rourke, then back to the fire. Over the cooking portion of the fire was a kettle that appeared to be made of paper-thin bark. Food simmered in it. The dog meat? Paul's eyes passed from the fire and the disgusting-sounding but appealing-smelling meal to the shape in the far corner. Huddled beneath a parka and an emergency blanket was Natalia Anastasia Tyomarovna, her normally pale complexion paler still. Her eyelids fluttered, her lips looked parched, pale, and drawn, moving as though reciting some silent litany. John went to her. As he moved her slightly, kneeling beside her, part of the coverings fell away, and Paul could see she wore John's gray woolen sweater. There was a smell of human waste. John Rourke looked up from his knees beside her, and Paul Rubinstein looked into his friend's eyes.
Paul!
Tears filled John Rourke's eyes. Paul supposed he would have felt more awkward if he were not a married man, but it didn't help him much. He was stunned by her physical beauty as he helped John care for her. John bathed her with warm water from the fire, and as Rubinstein began to put out the fire, John buried the emergency blanket. It was too soiled. The sweater suffered the same fate. With every breath, Natalia's lips formed John's name, but no sound escaped. Annie Rourke Rubinstein could not sleep. She was the logical one to be left behind. She knew that, and she respected logic, but she hated its result. Michael went forth to do what needed to be done. Maria as well, because of her understanding of archaeology and anthropology and her greater familiarity with computer technology. Han Lu Chen joined them because of his Chinese appearance, knowledge of the language, and greater knowledge of the second Chinese city. Annie Rourke Rubinstein was left to travel alone to the rendezvous. She closed her eyes tightly, as she had when she was a little girl and been told that it was bedtime, and she couldn't sleep. She couldn't sleep now. It was almost time to take the special they'd left her and go on toward the rendezvous. She was cold, despite the climate-controlled small tent in which she huddled. She had things to do. Dismantle the tent and make it to the rendezvous. Things to do. She sat up suddenly, feeling Natalia's pain, and there was confusion such as she had never known. Confusion and despair. Sarah Rourke hugged the thermal blanket closer around her. By the light of the lanterns, she watched the grim faces of Colonel Wolfgang Mann and his officers as they pored over the maps she spent the better part of the day drawing. Her right thumb ached. A third of the first Chinese city was occupied by the Soviet invaders, including the government buildings. To make matters worse, while Colonel Mann's forces were airborne, dealing heavy blows to the Soviet gunships, Soviet ground forces attacked the only marginally defended base camp, killed the men stationed there, and kidnapped the Chinese chairman and his party. The government of the first city was in the hands of the Soviets, but Chinese forces resisted valiantly.
You may not be through yet with your duties, Frau Rourke. If I may be so presumptuous, I suggest that you rest.
For the baby's sake, she did rest, thankful that conscious dreaming was something she no longer experienced. The terror of being awake was enough. When Colonel Mann sent one of his officers to awaken her, she joined them at once. Now he turned away from the map table and looked across the tent toward her.
I have, Frau Rourke, spent considerable time attempting to find a suitable alternative, but I'm afraid our best hope for success is that you should accompany us into the city. Your knowledge of the government complex is beyond what we can learn from any map. If you say no, I will fully understand.
Would your wife say no? Did she when my husband and I and the others helped your city?
By the lantern light, she saw a smile raise the corners of his mouth. He clicked his heels as he bowed quickly to her.
Gentlemen?
His officer saluted her, and she felt herself beginning to blush. Kuranami studied the green lights of the control console.
Corporal!
All is in order, Lieutenant!
Headset on, then! Good luck!
The same to you, Lieutenant!
Kuranami adjusted his headset.
This is Retribution Leader to Squadron. We will pass over the foothills and attack the Soviet base from the west as planned. Maintain radio silence except in an emergency until engagement. Retribution Leader out.
He clicked off. They were not, of course, planning to pass over the foothills and attack from the west. If the Soviet gunships refueling and rearming in the narrow valley to the north did not have the German radio frequencies monitored, he missed his guess. And he would be dead. He gave a last-minute check to his instruments as he got the fast-handling German gunship slotted into formation. Visibility was satisfactory through the light snow. There was a funnel-shaped, exceedingly narrow canyon guarded on both sides by heavy machine guns, as his ground reconnaissance confirmed before dark. But only two guns guarded each side, and one missile battery backed up the double machine gun teams on each side. The somewhat light armament made sense. Though the canyon provided direct access into the Soviet staging area, it was considered too narrow for an airborne attack. The tight space, added to unpredictable updrafts, made attempting a raid through the canyon tantamount to suicide, which, of course, made it the only logical approach. Akira Kuranami changed pitches, slipped the machine northward and down the terrain following the dried riverbed, which, centuries before, cut the canyon from rock. He looked to right and left, his squadron beginning to take up the attack formation, a single column following his lead. He glanced at his wristwatch. In 5 minutes, they would reach the canyon.